Buzz.
I'm an alcoholic. I apologize for being late. We were kind of waiting for another guy that didn't show, so. I'm just going to get right to it, and I'm going to quit at 7:30, and if any, I'll be around after the meeting for a minute, so if anybody has any questions, I'll just answer them. This is a big step. It's step six, and I'm going to get right to it. As I said before, I'm going to skip the disclaimer, but this is my experience and my, it's how I work the steps. And this is step six. In 1945, World War II was coming to an end. Italy and Germany had already fallen, and the Allies decimated the Japanese Air Force and Navy. The Japanese were driven out of major strongholds in the Pacific, but Japan refused to surrender. Thus, the U.S. bombed Hiroshima and Nagasaki, killing over 80,000 in each city and mortally wounding thousands more. The Emperor of Japan overrode his military commanders who wished to fight to the last man and made a decision to surrender, facing total destruction. His representative surrendered in Tokyo Bay to General MacArthur on the USS Missouri. The Japanese representative asked his interpreter to translate the terms of the surrender, and MacArthur said, "Don't read it, just sign it." That was an unconditional surrender. They had no say in anything. It's what they had to do to survive. And, you know, and the thing is, we've all experienced this. If you're in this room and looking at me, we've experienced it. The surrender was unconditional. And, you know, in our big book it says half measures avail us nothing. It's, we have to surrender to our disease, to God, or we're going to perish just like the Japanese, because I'm sure we had three more bombs that were almost ready and they were on the way to Japan, and we had five more even bigger ones waiting, so I think we'd have kept bombing them until they'd have got tired of getting bombed before we got tired of bombing them, you know? Now, in another totally different war, the U.S. had a general, his nickname was Audie, and Audie refused to surrender. Audie was his nickname. His real name was General Armstrong Custer. Like I said, every one of us in this room surrendered because the pain of our addiction got too powerful and too big for us. And step six says we were entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character. And the 12 and 12, it says this step separates the men from the boys, which is a very sexist remark. But it was written in 1951, and that was a very sexist time. I think it'd be more appropriate to say it separates the adolescents from the adults. This is where we grow up, and it's the pinnacle of where the change starts to happen, you know. Bill Wilson wrote this in 1957. It's from Alcoholics Anonymous, comes to page 105. And I'm going to read it word for word. It's not real proper English in a couple places, but I'm going to still read it. Many people wonder how AA can function under such seeming anarchy. Other societies have to have law, enforce, sanction, and punishment administered by authorized people. Happily for us, we found no need for human authority whatever. We have two authorities which are far more effective. One is benign, the other malign. There is God, our Father, who simply says, "I'm waiting for you to do my will." The other authority is named John Barleycorn, and he says, "You better do God's will or I'll kill you." and he sometimes does kill. So when the chips are down, we confirm to God's will or perish. At this level, the death sentence hangs over every AA member, his group, and AA as a whole. Now, the reason I'm reading this is because, you know, step six says we're entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character. My opinion is, what that translates to is we are entirely ready to surrender our defects of character to God, as I understand them, because I can't handle it. And it has to be an unconditional surrender. An unemployed carpenter once said, "The truth will set you free." And Joe McHugh said, "But first, the truth will make you miserable." And I think that's true. Because in step four and five, we look at ourselves and it makes us miserable. Steps four and five show us the truth about ourselves. And the truth is, I'm going to use the word painful. That's why step four says a fearless moral inventory. Question: why do drunks talk about step four as an awful experience, procrastinating taking step four? Why? Answer is because it's painful to look at ourselves in step four and five. Let's face it, the truth makes us miserable because of perceived pain of changing. You know, little kids are afraid of the dark because they don't know what's out there. And when we have to change, I know I was very scared to become sober because I didn't know what it was going to be like. I'd never been sober. I was sober for 17 days twice, but once the first 5 days was in detox, and the other time the first 5 days was in jail. A few weeks ago when I was answering questions, I think it was step two, but I wouldn't swear to it, a young lady asked me, "How do you catch yourself on a dry drunk and know when to get back to basics?" And I can't remember what I answered her, but the answer is pain. Pain. And step six, again, I'll say we became entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character. You know what made me? The only thing that ever made me willing to change just about anything is pain. I believe pain is the most essential ingredient in motivating us to surrender, just as the Japanese. I believe it is imperative for pain to provide the motivation in order to change. So when you're in pain, I tell new guys that are just detoxing, and they're miserable. You know, you get a new guy that just introduced, go talk to him, because it's the worst day of his life, because none of us came here till we're beat into coming here by John Barleycorn. I'm going to repeat that because I believe it's that important. I believe pain is the most important ingredient in motivating us to surrender. I believe it's imperative for pain to provide the motivation in order to change. When I was on the Appalachian Trail, they would say, "No pain, no Maine. You ain't going to make it." And then you have to, you know, I mean, there's a lot of pain in involving it. I have a motorcycle in the barn that doesn't run. And it doesn't run. I did a fourth step myself, which was wrong. I called in help, did a fifth step. And damn motorcycle still doesn't run. And the reason it doesn't run, because I either got to pay some money to get it fixed, or I got to fix it. And it's not painful enough to do. You know, I just, I'll do it. Maybe next year, you know, it's winter now. Maybe next spring, maybe not. I'm going to share a little bit of my experience with pleasure and pain. Let's take a look at my past. Now, everything I ever had to give up to recover was good at first. And actually, the first thing that I remember, pleasure and pain, was I was about 19 years old and I got high on marijuana and I thought, this is it. And I smoked marijuana for about 4 years. Didn't hardly drink in those 4 years. But marijuana is a big molecule. And my immune system started to recognize it. And it started to make me sick. My heart would beat hard. I'd get sick to my stomach. Hair'd stand up on my neck. And then I started getting paranoid. And I got worse and worse until it was like smoking pure fear. And the pain got so bad, and this was a long time before I quit my addiction. I quit smoking marijuana because it was too painful. I just substituted with a lot of alcohol, Valium, and opiates, and they worked. My addiction to alcohol was so poor. The first time I drank, I thought, this is the nectar of the gods. Of course, I'm the only one in here that ever said that, you know. And I thought, this is great, because all that depression, anxiety, low self-esteem, you know, it just melted away. And I felt, whew, it was great. And I didn't quit drinking until I weighed 125 pounds and was literally going to die. The pain was so bad that I went from hoping I'd hurry up and die to 5 minutes later I was afraid I was going to, and 5 minutes later I was hoping I was going to die, you know. And the pain was so great, so I cried out and I surrendered unconditionally. I went to AA 35 months before that happened, and I knew I was an alcoholic because I had that spiritual connection that goes on here. And I knew I didn't know the guy that gave the lead, but I connected spiritually, and I thought I was pretty sure I was an alcoholic. In fact, I knew I was an alcoholic that night, but I didn't quit drinking for 35 months because there wasn't enough pain. You know, there was some pain. My wife left me. That's kind of painful, but, you know, it wasn't that bad. But anyway, and I kept drinking. Nicotine, that was my go-to drug. I was both smoking and chewing, and I used to say that, you know, you could smoke at the meetings. And I can remember when the meetings started going non-smoking, I said, nobody will ever go to them. Us drunks have to smoke. Until the pain got so bad, I couldn't breathe. I was afraid of lung cancer. I was going to die. When it was right in front of my face. Now, this is important because you know how I told you in the first steps how I thought I was an atheist at first, and then I thought, well, I'm agnostic, and then I started to believe a little bit in step 3 and step 4 and a little more in step 5. By step 6, when I gave up nicotine, one of the things, I was coming to Fairview, and there was a sign. It was a white sign, and it had 3 words on it. It said, pray, it works. And I prayed right then on the way to Fear. You know, I've never smoked a cigarette, chewed snuff since. And I thought, maybe there is something to this God thing, you know. My job that I had got so painful, I couldn't concentrate on anything. I was working the job most of my time. I would go to bed about 11 o'clock, I'd go to sleep, and about 1 o'clock I'd wake up with it in my head. And it got so painful, and I got so wired up that I surrendered. I quit. I thought maybe I'll starve to death, and so far that was in 2011. So I ate this morning, I ate this afternoon, and I ate this evening. And as you can tell, I could probably use a good famine, because if I lost 20 pounds, it wouldn't hurt me. Now, the 6 things I just mentioned, listed above, are not moral defects of character. None of them. But they were things that I had to surrender because the pain got so bad I couldn't go on. Okay. And actually, in step three, I talked about Gallagher says, we made a decision, and now we have to do some things. And the first thing we had to do is an inventory of what blocked me from God. Joe McHugh says that. And these six things were all, and there's been many more. I mean, I've had a lot of things I had to give up because they were blocking me spiritually. Character, and here, these, I thought these are more handicaps than character defects. And I just want to say this because there's been a lot of controversy over the difference between character defects and shortcomings. And they asked Bill Wilson, the guy that wrote it, what's the difference? He says, there isn't any. I just didn't want to use the same word in two steps in a row. So character defects, handicaps, and shortcomings are all the same thing as far as Bill's was concerned. Now, these weren't moral shortcomings or moral character defects that I just said. Let's take a look at some of my moral character defects. Step four and five gave us a moral character defect to-do list to carry into step six. Things that we needed to surrender to God to avoid the pain. Many people in AA, including Father Martin and Bob Darrell, some people that I really respect and hold on this pedestal, talk about step six as a second surrender. And actually, we've all been through it because we had to, you're in this room tonight by choice. Maybe somebody had to get their shit signed. I don't know. But because that does happen, you know. But anyway, it's a second surrender. Now, here we are. We're armed with this to-do list from step four and five. And I want to read a quote of one sentence in the big book that's very, very important. And it's from quote from page 71. It's towards the end of the chapter in the big book. It's one sentence. If you have already made a decision and an inventory of your grosser handicaps, you have made a good beginning. Okay. I had a list of 194 character defects. I started giving out. And you have every one of them because it's a racial thing. You're part of the human race. And actually, they aren't character defects. They're character traits. And that's why you have all of them. Now, grosser handicaps. And that's the only time they mention the big book. Joe McHugh goes into some more detail about the grosser handicaps. And I've kind of went into detail myself, probably because of my background. According to all the theories that I was forced to study theories for 25 years, and mostly agree, core issues are developed before the age of 5 to 8. And I ran this by my bride today, and she says, I think it's about 3 to 8. But our core values. There was a book one time, I never read it, but it said, everything I ever needed to know socially, I learned before I went to kindergarten. We learn things young. And I'm going to give you a simple example of core issues. And I believe Bill was describing core issues on page 71 when he used the word handicapped. And a good example of a core issue is speaking English. I speak English. And that's my core language, because nobody ever taught me English. I learned it by emulating the people that raised me. And probably at two, I was saying mama and dad, and they were real happy about it. I might have said, if you have little kids between two and three, I think they learn more and everything. And you're real happy when they're saying mama and dad. Then comes no. And if you have a kid that age, you say the F word one time and they repeat it right in front of grandma, you know. It's like your mother-in-law or something, you know, and they come out with that. But anyway, most of us were probably talking and arguing with our parents by the time we were three. I don't remember that, but I'm still speaking in English, and it's my core language, and it always will be. Now, I'm going to use an example of what happens with your core issues. And most of you in here are probably old enough to remember the sitcom I Love Lucy. Lucy was married, played by Lucille Ball. And I think in real life she was married to Desi Arnaz. She played Lucy Ricardo in the movie, and he was Ricky Ricardo. Now, Ricky was from Cuba, and in Cuba they speak Spanish, so his core language was Spanish. He spoke fluent English. He had an accent, but you could understand him perfectly, until he got pissed off and upset at Lucy, and then he would go out this, you know, speaking Spanish. He reverted back, and that's one of the things. I have core issues. And in times of stress, I revert back to them. Not that I want to, but I do. Paul was having this trouble in Romans 14, I think, where he says, I know better, but I still do it. So he was doing the same thing. And that was a couple thousand years ago, so kind of nothing's changed, I guess. Anyway, if you'll permit me, I'm going to share the pleasure and pain of my grosser handicaps. My grosser handicaps are in column 5 on the 4-step form are shortcomings. And after you've done quite a few, there's certain shortcomings that pop up on almost all my 4 steps. All my resentments, all my harms done to others, my fears, my sexual harms, and there's a short list. Actually, it's got 3, and then it has a secondary one, and I'll talk about that. Controlling. I'm very controlling. I'm very impatient, and I'm also defiant and rebellious. That's one. You could also add a couple other words to it, but I'm defiant. Those are my grosser handicaps. Now, I have a secondary one, and it's a secondary core issue, and it's because of those 3 I'm inconsiderate, because it's usually caused by one or more of the above issues. Now, I don't want you to think all I have is 3 character defects, because I'll tell you what, in certain instances, there's 194, all of them have come up at one time or another in my life, you know. There's a lot of, but these are the ones that are core that I revert back to. Take controlling. That was kind of pleasurable. I had the illusion of being, I love the illusion of being in control. You know, that money, property, and prestige. Oh, the prestige, being in control, the boss, the grand poobah. And I felt safe when I was in control, and it fed my ego. Now, after a while, I started losing friends, and I didn't know why. I started not getting invited places, and I didn't know why. I was getting shunned, and I didn't know why. Relationships, people I worked with, and the pain got so bad, I had to surrender it. That's impatience. Oh, I want instant gratification. God grant me patience, and damn it, grant it to me right now. I hate waiting for anything, and you know, I said many times, I just said this to Marilyn, I hate deer hunting, but I like shooting deer. I hate fishing. There's people that say, oh, I don't care if I catch anything or not. I just like fishing. Well, I'll tell you what. When I go fishing, if I don't catch anything, I'm pissed. When I go fishing, I want to catch fish. And I don't want to take all day to do it either, you know? I mean, this caused trouble in my relationships. Just ask Scooter when she's in the house a couple minutes longer when I want to get to the meeting and I blow the horn. Boy, that pleases her. Some of you guys are laughing. That's experience I'm seeing on your face, you know? Hey, I can't see you as being impatient, Kevin. But anyway, I have blown many opportunities in my life being impatient, and it was that kind of pain that caused me to surrender. Defiant, rebellious. Oh man, it caused me problems with my father from earliest childhood memories. You know, don't play with fire. I used to build forts in the woods. I love building cabins even today, and I'd have to tear them down after I got them built. And one time, and I knew I wasn't supposed to, I thought it won't be that big a fire. And guess what? I was wrong. So when the fire trucks came, mom and dad weren't home, and the fire trucks came, and I'm thinking, come on, you guys are taking forever. Get out of here. And dad drove in, and there's the fire trucks. And there was this little fire chief in Cambridge. And dad always hated it when you pointed your finger, and there's this little fire chief, and he's in my dad's face going like this. And I'm thinking, oh, man, I'm going to get killed. I'm dead. It was nice being alive. Defiant rebellious caused me trouble with all kinds of authority, not just my parents, teachers, bosses, cops, judges. Boss hate. You know, I had trouble with authority figures. Every boss I had was kind of thought they were in control and authority, and the pain got so bad I realized I got to, you know. And the thing is with cops, they sound polite. Sir, would you mind stepping out of the car? They're polite then, but if you say no, they'll drag your ass right through that window. You know, so there. But anyway, and inconsiderate, you can see how I would get inconsiderate with these above issues. Now, it's pain, and because of the pain, the pain got so bad that I finally cried out to give it, to surrender it to God. Take this away, I can't do it. Actually, my pain, when I quit drinking, you know, I wanted to do it by myself, and that gets real painful real quick, you know. And I'm here tonight because I can't stay sober by myself. That's the bad news. The good news is I've never had to. You know, I got all you folks and more. Now, I have to continue to battle with surrendering to all my character defects, because we were talking about Bob Olson gave a lead at the spring conference, and he says, I keep working the steps because of the resurgence of my ego. And you know, I kind of talked about that in step three. Things get going good, and okay, God, I can handle this, and my life's unmanageable. It was when I was drinking, and I thought it would be manageable when I quit drinking. I still cannot manage my life, and I still have to work on letting go of these things because they cause pain. And there is other things. There is other things that come up. These are just my core issues, and these are the biggies. My sponsees are right there. Core character defects on a card, and I laminate it. And I say, when I ask you to see this, I want, you best have it in your wallet. You don't have it in your wallet? Oh, geez. We'll talk. Step six, we became entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character. And like I said, I had to become entirely ready to surrender these, just like the Japanese. I have to surrender these, Katie. They're too big for me. I want to close with, I often, you know, I go to step meetings a lot, and I like to go to step meetings. There's about two a week in Meadville that I go to, not every week, but as regularly as I can. And when step six comes up and it goes around and everybody puts their, you know, we discuss it, I often hear people say, when step six is discussed, some people say, I have some character defects I want to keep. Question, why would anyone want to keep a character defect? It's simple. The character defect provides more pleasure than pain at that time. Bob Darrell tells a story about his brother-in-law thinking he's a chicken and running down the street naked and clucking and everything. And he goes to the psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist says, I'll solve your problem. Just fill out these papers. I haven't committed, and your problem's done. And then the guy says, yeah, you know, Doc, but I don't know if I can do without the eggs. All character defects have eggs. Drinking had eggs. Smoking marijuana had eggs. My controlling had eggs. Impatience, oh boy. Defiance, they all had eggs. All my character defects and a lot of things that are good. You know, I love ice cream. I could live off ice cream. But there's a downside to it, you know? But see, I think I'm going to eat some ice cream tonight when I get home. Sit in front of the fireplace and eat a half gallon of ice cream. The answer is simply that character defect provides more pleasure than pain. And how much pain do you tolerate? If I want to keep any of my character defects, it's because the pleasure outweighs the pain. They have not caused me enough pain to surrender. And there's a three-letter word, yet. And that's a big three-letter word. Just hasn't got to me yet. And I this was going to be one of my longest lectures, and I think I did pretty good. But anyway, I'm going to close with that. I really sincerely hope step six, I hope what I said tonight made sense. Because I had a hard time understanding step six and seven because I thought, that's simple. I'm ready to have God remove the defects of character, and I humbly ask Him, and it's done. I don't have to do anything. I'm laying quite a bit on God. But you know that motorcycle that's in the barn? It still don't run. And I wonder if I ask God just to fix it, if He would. Probably not. We have four minutes for questions. No, Mike? No, Mike. So no questions. Just speak loud. Any questions for? I'll repeat it. Quick.
Eggs. Elaborate a little bit on the character defects having eggs.
I use that as like a parable. All character defects have a benefit. Okay. Drinking had a benefit. I loved drinking. It had a benefit, but it got so painful. And controlling has eggs. I love to be in control. But when it got, you know, when I start losing friends and stuff like that and making enemies because I'm controlling, I start getting pain. And that's just it. The eggs, there's always eggs. There's always a reason to hang on to character. You know, I deer hunt. And years ago, I had a 760 Game Masters. It's a pump. And I could buy 10 round clips, and I'd tape them together. And when a deer came through, I filled the whole woods with it. It's going ready to kill people. Because, I mean, I was throwing. And somebody says, why don't you just take your time and shoot once? And I said, I like shooting. Can't kill any. You know, I don't like to be patient. I don't like to wait. I don't like to, you know. I mean, if I was allowed to use dynamite when I'm fishing, it'd be a lot better than a fly rod and a fly. You know what I mean? Does that kind of answer it? There's, if you want to keep a character defect, you don't want to keep something that's totally no good to you. And you, and I think this is universal. All of us hung on to our drinking for as long as we can. And it was, we came here because we were beat half to death by our addictions, why we came here. And I don't know for you, about you, but for me, drinking probably wasn't fun for the last 5 years of my drinking. I don't think I had a good time. It was like work and pain. Finally, I thought, it occurred to me, maybe I could stop doing this shit, you know? And that's what I was talking about with the eggs. Thanks, Jim. Anybody else?
Yeah. That's what I'm curious. I'm sure I'm going to have to ask this question after I'm going to go to the car. What happens to the spontaneous mystery car?
I kill him. Now. Yeah, I break out. No. You know, if you're going to have sponsees, you're going to have trouble. My son was he was cranking to his sponsor about having car trouble, and his sponsor said, "You know why you have car trouble? You're fortunate enough to have a car." And you know, I was reading the Gospels this year, and Jesus Christ had 12 sponsees, and they pissed him off a lot. You know, I mean, I could just about hear them when I think it was Peter and somebody else were arguing about who would sit at his right side in heaven. And he says, look, you dipshits, how many times do I got to tell you? It doesn't matter. And when they were in the boat and they got all scared, he came out, he scolded them. So I think that's been going on. That was 2,000 years ago. And if you're fortunate enough to have sponsees, I mean, I have sponsees that have done some incredibly, where I'm going, damn. And how many of y'all have sponsees? Then you know what the hell I'm talking about, don't you? It's going to happen, Mark. You don't kill them, you just keep loving them. They go out, they come back. It's 7:31, so we are over time, and I'm quitting. Marilyn's doing.